Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is brought to you by Jewel, sous vide by Chef Steps. Jewel takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Last week, the day after Thanksgiving, U.S. government agencies released the much-anticipated Fourth National Climate Assessment, which assesses the state of the climate across the U.S. It's safe to say that the report's findings were bleak. It stated in clear terms that without substantial and sustained reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, climate change will hurt people, economies, and resources across the country. Joining the show today to discuss the effects that the report's authors say climate change will have on our food and ag systems specifically is Marcia DeLong. Marcia is a senior scientist in the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she conducts scientific research and analyzes identifying practices that lead to healthy and sustainable food and farming systems. Marcia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, before we dig into this topic, can you just tell us a little bit more about the Union of Concerned Scientists and what the organization does?
Absolutely. So the Union of Concerned Scientists is a national nonprofit organization. We were founded nearly five decades ago by scientists at MIT, and our mission is really to put science into action. So we work to develop and implement innovative solutions to some of our planet's most urgent problems, and those are include but aren't limited to combating global warming and also developing a more sustainable food system. So that's what we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, and I feel like now more than ever, your organization is really needed to help.
We keep ourselves busy.
Yes, to, you know, put out facts and help people, make people believe them. Okay, so I'm going to ask like a really, really basic question for anyone who is confused by the terminology and the kind of process by which climate change works. You know, I mean, I think that it might be worth talking about this since we have a president who makes statements like, brutal and extended cold blast could shatter all records, whatever happened to global warming. So with that in mind, that's where we are as a country right now. That's where we're at. So with that in mind, can you give us a brief overview of what's entailed with climate change? How does it work? And what are the main drivers?
Sure. So climate change is really referring to changes in average weather conditions over the long term. So we're talking about decades or more. So while weather is what we experience on a shorter time frame, and we want to know if it's going to be hot or cold, if it's going to be rainy or dry, and whether there's a chance of a big storm, climate change is really thinking about those long-term shifts in what we experience in any particular place. So today we know we're experiencing climate change in a variety of ways, and that's what we'll be talking about. Just one of those ways is that average surface air temperatures have increased by about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 115 years. So that's just one example of a long-term shift in our climate.
Okay.
In terms of the drivers, this is what we know is human activities. So it's emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, and that's from fossil fuel combustion.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do every day to use the energy that we use when we're burning fossil fuels, we're putting more of these heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere. When we do that, that prevents, it helps absorb heat in the atmosphere near the Earth's surface. That prevents heat from escaping into space. We want a certain amount of that to happen. We want a habitable climate, but when we keep increasing those concentrations of greenhouse gases, then it means that it's warming. It's actually changing what we experience here on Earth.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That was super, super helpful. Great summary. Yeah. So what about this, and think about this report, where did it come from? Like, who mandated it and for what purpose?
Yeah. So this report is mandated by Congress. It's meant to be released about every 4 years. And it's meant to assess the past, the present, and the future of climate change, what it means to us in the United States. It's actually produced by 13 federal departments and agencies. They make up a thing called the U.S. Global Change Research Program.
Mm-hmm.
So this includes USDA, NOAA, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, all the agencies that probably come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
And through this, so we have this group, and then these 13 agencies, and then within that, about 300 federal and non-federal authors actually contributing to this report. So
wow.
it's a big deal.
Yeah,
it's a big thing.
It's quite. It's a lot of pages.
It is a lot of pages.
1,600 of them. Okay, so and then what are the main kind of chapters and topics that the report covers? It seems very comprehensive.
I'm impressed that you even know how many pages it is. I think the easier way to navigate this report is online, and then you kind of can click through the different chapters. So for anyone who's listening, it's not just one thick PDF really that you're looking at. You're actually kind of having an experience in which you can find your way around what the report is talking about, and it does a lot of different things. It gives an overview of the report because it needs several different levels of summaries. It gives an overview of how a lot of our different sectors and land use types are being affected by climate change. So that means water, energy, land use, forests, ecosystems, our coasts, oceans, urban areas, transportation, air quality, human health, pretty much
everything,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, everything is being affected in a different way. And so it was really important for this report to have a way for people who are like, oh, well, what's going on with transportation, to be able to take a look
quickly.
It also, what was one of the things that was new in this particular report, this is the fourth one of the series of national climate assessments to date, is that it really went deep into regions. So it had a separate chapter for different regions across the U.S., and that's why it has 29 chapters this time around, partly because of these regional additions.
Yeah. And this is the second volume of the fourth assessment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, what was the first one? I think it was from 2017. What are the differences between the two?
Right. So this time they decided to do this in two volumes because what they wanted to do is to actually release the climate science foundation first.
Mm-hmm.
So the basics of what we know about physical science, the physical science of climate science, to come out in its own report, which was in November of last year. And then this new report, Volume 2, is really about saying, okay, now that we know that these things are happening with climate science, what does that mean for impacts and risks for the United States? And then also, what does that mean for what we can do to adapt and what we can do to mitigate?
Okay. All right. That's really helpful. So this is different than the report that came out in October by the UN, right?
obviously
also different
not.
Also different than that. Yes, that was
a lot of reports these days. It's almost like something needs to happen. Like, this is a really big deal.
I will tell you, if anyone out there is having trouble keeping track of these, you are not alone.
Yeah.
I mean, I work on this every day, and it's even hard to sort out all of the different things that are coming out from the different groups and organizations. But yes, it's clearly a steady drumbeat, and clearly we need to be paying attention.
Yeah, hopefully this report kind of gets the job done. You know, I have to say, like, it was dumped, right? This report was dumped. And my understanding reading it was just like kind of rushed. Like, all of a sudden the government was like, no, we're going to release it now in like 5 days. You know, the authors didn't have even a lot of heads up about when it was going to be released. And then it was like dumped on a day where it was people were expected to maybe not be paying attention. And of course, those are my opinions on how the report was released. But it seems to me that this kind of struck a chord in a way that I haven't seen recently with putting this information out there. Have you found that to be true in terms of the response, public response to it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what happened with the report and when it was released and why.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the bottom line is that regardless of when it was released, it has received a lot of response. I think that says a lot, that something like this is now headline news for a lot of different groups and organizations, and you know, and that's, I think, as someone who's been working on this for a while, I think that's reassuring.
Yeah. Are you like, finally?
Sometimes, yeah, you know, you think, oh, well, you know, of course there's going to be a report like this, or of course people are going to talk about it. But then, you know, thinking back, it actually hasn't been that there's been so much visibility for something like this. Yeah, I'm really relieved that people are paying attention.
Definitely. Okay, so before we kind of dig into the chapters on food and agriculture and the effects that climate change will have on that, I'm wondering if you can kind of just outline some of these big overall takeaways that the report said in terms of like the effects of climate change, what we're seeing.
Sure. I mean,
I know that's like really hard to do. Yeah. So again, like a 1,000+ page report. And I'm like, can you just summarize it in like 5 bullets for us?
Well, I'll just reiterate what I said before. If anybody is actually interested in anything in particular about climate change impacts, then you should take a look at this amazing report online, because you can pretty easily navigate around to the issue areas that are most interesting, or the regions. But I'll just share a few things that struck me or stood out to me.
Yeah.
I mean, one is just that the very unambiguous, clear statement that human activity, primarily burning fossil fuels, is causing climate change. There is no credible alternative. You know, so
right.
This is just up there, clear. And reminding us that there's been this average temperature rise of 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, which, you know, might not sound like a lot. Again, if you're thinking about, like, the weather, and oh, it's a little more or less this day.
Right.
But when you think about this long-term climate shift, this is a big deal.
Because of the effects, like, I mean, can you just, like, spell that out a little bit? Like, it's a big deal because... Why?
Because this is the average change. So this means more of those extreme warm days more often. Mm-hmm. It also means that we're experiencing changes in rainfall, and that, I mean, even little tiny changes like just a shift in growing seasons, because we're going to be talking about agriculture, right, can wreak havoc on a crop. So if you're just going to see a shift in the growing season of a few days, but you have a crop that is, you know, kind of bred to be able to work with that region, then this is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that average change is the middle of, like, a low extreme and a high extreme.
Right.
And it's those extremes that are the real problems.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So then, you know, in addition to kind of just this basic review of the changes that we're seeing, I think it was really striking that the report talked about the economic losses that are going to be really significant. that are already significant, but they have predicted that the impacts of climate change could exceed $100 billion annually by the end of the century. So, I mean, and remembering that, you know, they were trying to be conservative, there's a lot of uncertainty. So $100 billion annually, that's like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And we may be underestimating our risk. And then, you know, just this kind of clear point that everyone in America, our health is at risk, and many populations are going to be particularly vulnerable. We're talking about heat waves, maybe changes that are going to affect allergies, make allergies worse, vector-borne diseases like Zika and West Nile becoming worse, just many things that you don't really necessarily think about when you think, oh, a little more heat. Mm-hmm. We're talking about livelihoods, we're talking about health, we're talking about billions of dollars to the economy, mm-hmm. On top of kind of the weather and climate changes that first come to mind.
Does the report talk at all about the effect on national security that it might have?
You know, that's not the part that I dug into in great detail, but I think it does touch on this quite a bit in a variety of different ways, and maybe it's the little pieces throughout the report that one needs to look at to realize, like,
right,
our infrastructure is at risk, our health is at risk,
yeah,
our food security is at risk,
migration, so, yeah, everything.
This is on the radar of the military.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the big, I mean, that's like a really important point, right? I mean, it's the same that you wouldn't necessarily like think about. The same way, by the way, obesity is on the radar of the, you know, of the military, because we have a lot of people in this country who aren't physically able to fight. Okay, so, but I digress.
Yes. It's related.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into, you know, the stuff that you really focused on, which is the effects on our food and agriculture system. I would like to kind of take some of these one by one, but like, you know, just one of the things that you wrote about was food insecurity. So mm-hmm. can you just kind of explore, help us just understand the connection?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the top message in the agriculture and rural communities chapter, because that was what it was. It wasn't just agriculture. It was also about rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
But the top message that these authors came up with was that climate change is going to reduce agricultural productivity. This is going to be because of droughts, wildfires, just the continued depletion of water supplies, increased weed and pest pressures, and, you know, the gradual changes in seasons combined with the more frequent or intense extreme events that we expect to see. So, you know, I mean, we're going to be in a situation where we're probably going to be growing less food. Our commodity crops are expected to be less productive, and you know, that, and it's probably going to be that more often there's going to be these extreme events that wipe out crops at times that we can't predict and we can't expect and we can't plan around. So there's that too. So when you think about all of these different pieces of ways in which the U.S. agricultural system could be really hit from a productivity standpoint,
mm-hmm.
And you recognize that even today, food insecurity affects 12% of U.S. households. I mean, we're not helping ourselves out, right? We have a big problem with food insecurity. Now we're saying, hey, there's going to be hits to agricultural productivity on many of our primary crops, and some of those are just going to be gradual, and some of those are going to be unexpected, disasters that are difficult to plan for.
We are, though, at a point of incredible productivity, though, right now, aren't we? I mean, we keep producing more and more and more. So is this going to be like a gradual decline or just kind of all at once?
No, I mean, this is gradual. But again, I think it's a combination of it's a combination of the fact that we're going to have these slow, gradual changes, shifts in what we can grow where, how well it's going to grow, and then And then, you know, an increasing number of disasters, in which case, you know, there's going to be major crop failures, and we're going to have to figure out what to do about that. Now, some of those might not be directly affecting the food supply, or maybe we have enough food, you know, but they are going to be affecting livelihoods. That's going to affect rural populations. We know that food insecurity is not just caused by
a lack of
productivity,
yeah.
a lack of food, and yeah. so there's all those things to consider as well. I mean, ultimately this is a huge strain on our food system, which involves a lot of people in this country. So it's partly about, yes, we're going to be growing less food probably. Also, we're going to have less food when we expect to have food because of the disaster kind of quality of a lot of these events that are becoming more problematic with climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just the strain of climate change on everything, and how much is expected to devastate communities, and then, you know, agricultural communities, rural communities being some of the most vulnerable, as this report put it.
What are some of the crops that the report points out that will be particularly affected?
Yeah, well, so a lot of the commodity crops that just the ones that kind of come to mind,
like,
you know,
corn,
soy, wheat, oats, cotton, silage. I mean, the other thing is that that we don't want to lose sight of is this risk of wildfire for a mm-hmm. lot of our grazing land. And so that's kind of, you don't always necessarily think of that as a crop, but that's really a source for food and for the livelihoods of ranchers as well.
Yeah, I bet people in California don't forget about
wildfire yeah.
right now. As, mm-hmm. yeah, so, but no, that's a really good point. I think that, so it's basically, I mean, would it be, in terms of like what were the effects of commodity crop decreased production really have on this country? Like, would that have more of an impact on our international, like on the international food supply, like kind of decreasing, or would that be more of an effect on the U.S. economy? Like, can we just dig into kind of those repercussions would be?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that with the agriculture, it's a lot. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's just a lot in it because it's, I don't know, maybe I sometimes think it's particularly complex, but maybe I just know it so well, so I know its complexities.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, U.S. agriculture, U.S. is a major exporter of agricultural goods. So there's, you know, anything that, and we are a major importer. You
mm-hmm.
know, we export a lot. So for sure, the countries who are importing our goods would be affected if we're growing less. But that kind of goes both ways. So there's this piece about trade and uncertainties in trade, you know, and then we don't necessarily know how production and consumption overall are going to be affected with climate change. You know, if you start to say, oh, okay, well, we've lost this crop, or now we can't grow this here anymore, there's major shifts that occur, how countries, regions, farming communities are going to respond, and then kind of what that means for anything really is really up in the air. So I think, you know, what we have to keep in mind is these impacts kind of carry a lot of side effects that we don't fully understand, but we do know from what we do know, from what the climate science says, and from what's happening on the ground right now, that we're dealing with some major changes ahead, and it can be hard to adapt. It can be hard to make change in agricultural systems, in any systems. And so, if we want to be able to be prepared for whatever is coming our way, then we need to start to take some more action.
Yeah. Are there particular, communities or regions that will be affected more than others? Like, I'm imagining the coasts, but I'm wondering if there are some things that maybe might not come to mind immediately that really, really will be impacted negatively.
Yeah, I mean, the coast with sea level rise, actually there's some really interesting research that has been coming out that's just saying, well, we have farms along like the eastern shore of Maryland, for example. Mm-hmm. And as sea level rises, these farms are literally, we're losing them underwater, and there's salt intrusion that comes. So that's, you know, one thing that really, I think, matches with the with the vision of like what climate change is and means. But our Midwest, you know, that's the place where we grow a lot of our corn and soybeans, and the report is very clear that corn and soybeans are at risk with climate change. And so there's a clear statement in the report that says that this is going to be a major factor in declines in the productivity of U.S. agriculture in the Midwest. The fires, you know, the grassland fires that, and the droughts that have been striking the Great Plains and the Midwest and California, and we expect these to increase. But really, I think that when you ask about what regions of the country will be more affected or how, I mean, really nobody's getting away without being affected. Yeah. I mean, that's what really stands out to me.
Yeah. What are farmers' attitudes towards climate change? Like, do they accept that it's real and caused by humans, or do they even call it climate change? Like, where are they on this issue?
I think it would be a mistake to think about farmers as one uniform group.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of my initial takeaway.
Certainly.
But you know, it's clear that there are farmers out there who are really clear that climate change is affecting them, and that they want to take some action in response. So two groups that come to mind, of two groups of farmers that come to mind as being really active in this space, are the National Farmers Union. Mm-hmm. They actually have a climate leaders community, so they are fully recognizing that, you know, farmers and ranchers are at the front lines of climate change and working to figure out how we combat this, how what farmers can be doing. And then the National Young Farmers Coalition, and they have done a lot of work on trying to figure out what young farmers need and how they can better advocate for them. And they had a survey out, a report out in 2017, and it was pretty clear that a lot of their members who responded to this survey have been seeing unpredictable weather, severe storms, and so on, and that they attribute these changes to climate change. So do these farmers represent all farmers? No, by no means. But I think it's, you know, important to realize that there's farmers in different parts of the country, there's farmers on different types of farms and sizes of farms and in different communities, and that really changes things.
So the report offers a number of kind of suggested next steps and ways that we can really help kind of mitigate at least the size of the impact of climate change. So what are some that, okay, wait, let me let me just start that question over again. The report talks about like suggested solutions, things that people can do and that farmers specifically can do now to help mitigate like long-term seriously negative effects of climate change. So what are some of those suggested solutions or guidelines that is entailed in the report? Talked about in the report.
Yeah. So really, I mean, it boils down to, you know, farmers being able to choose what they can grow where, what they use to grow, what they grow where, right? So what their inputs are, like the fertilizers and pesticides, water, you know, whether or not they can adopt some new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of management practices. And a lot of the management practices that are recommended in this report and in many other reports, as we mentioned, there are lots of reports,
mm-hmm.
Are things like crop rotations, cover crops, for how you manage what's growing on your farm, and then things like, irrigation management or precision management or figuring out like how best you can put less fertilizer and the fertilizer in just the right place on your farm, you know, across your crop field so that it's well matching and that you don't have too much where you don't need it, which is just helping to make sure that the impacts of any new extreme weather or changes in the weather and climate don't exacerbate problems that farmers are already dealing with, like what with water quality and water conservation and so on.
Okay. So, yeah, I was going to say, like, okay, so pick crop rotation. What is the connection between crop rotation and, you know, reducing vulnerabilities to climate change? Can you just dig into that a little bit? And how that will help mitigate, you know, how what farmers can do to kind of not only like safeguard against what the effects the changes will have, but also help prevent further, you know, increase in greenhouse like emissions.
Yeah, right. Because there's two pieces of this. One is that you know, it'd be great. And we need for farmers and ranchers and agriculture and the food system as a whole to reduce their own footprint, climate change footprint, because mm-hmm. agriculture in the U.S. contributes 9% of our U.S. emissions. And so there's a real opportunity there. It's mm-hmm. a real opportunity to just reduce emissions. But then the other piece is that agriculture can also, farmers can help they can actually remove carbon from the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide is one of these big greenhouse gases, right? And so, but that's carbon, and there's a carbon cycle, and the carbon can be in the atmosphere, carbon can be in soils, carbon can be in plants. And so if farmers can get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and into plants and into soils, then that can also help mitigate climate change. And then there's the layer of adaptation, which is really like absolutely critical and what we need to be making sure we're making progress in right away, because farmers are already facing the impacts of climate change. So adaptation is key while we mitigate, you know, we need to be adapting and vice versa. So crop yeah. rotations, mm-hmm. Something like crop rotations, what we're really talking about, instead of growing one crop year after year in the same place, to be really thinking strategically about growing, mixing that up and growing more than one crop in the same place and rotating it from year to year, so that there's actually one thing to realize about crops is that they kind of give and take different things from the soil mm-hmm. And from the environment. And so if you rotate crops, then you can get a little, you can bring some balance to that farming system. So what we want to be doing to mitigate climate change is to get to really build soil health, to make sure that we have crops in that rotation that are kind of giving back more of the soil than they take. So, for example, bringing nitrogen-fixing crops so that we maybe don't need to use so much fertilizer, which is associated with greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay.
So I think I'm rambling a little bit on this.
No, this is great.
Exciting things to talk about.
Yeah. No, it's helpful to kind of, you know, make the connections, because we talk a lot about things like the importance of cover crops, you know, but it's like actually making the connection in terms of like the full list of benefits that could come out of something so maybe seemingly simple. What is the, in terms of making these changes, like, have you, what are kind of farmers' attitudes, like new practices? I think anything new introducing to the farming community can sometimes be met with like a little reticence, right? Like it's a hard enough job in and of itself at right now, and margins are super like razor thin. And so when you kind of come at farmers like, hey, I think you should be doing this, which might cost, you know, more in some way, there can be some apprehension. So have, you know, in your work with the community, have you found that there is a little bit of a reticence, or are farmers pretty welcoming of making some of these changes?
I think the bottom line, as you said, is there's risk involved with bringing on new practices. There's sometimes new equipment, there's upfront costs. There's a transition time for making things work, right? Like you might try a crop rotation. You don't really know until you're 3 or 4 years through if it's really working for you, or if it's, you know, you have all the kinks worked out in your management style. And so, I think we have to recognize that there's a lot of risk involved. What we can help, I think there's a lot of different ways that we can help to mitigate those risks as a country, as a community. I mean, we have research that can help show that, oh, these practices work really well, and we're continuing to make them work better. And not only that, but we're going to make sure that they work in your region, in your microclimate. They're going to work for you. We can provide technical assistance so that when you're having a problem, we can provide support. Mm-hmm. And then we also can be trying to find ways of, through like the Farm Bill, which is the other big thing happening right now, and yeah. I know your listeners have heard about that recently, but thinking about like the safety net for when something goes wrong, you know, how can we make sure that farmers have a safety net so that through crop insurance or whatever. But the problem is that we, you know, there's a lot of weak spots in all of those pieces right now. You know, we haven't necessarily been in the United States doing a great job of fully funding our public research for climate change and agriculture in particular, for sustainable agriculture, for agriculture as a whole. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. If there's not technical assistance available, which we've heard is an issue.
Yeah, it's so little. I think like the primary technical assistance available to farmers right now is through the actual pesticide companies itself, which is so ironic and unhelpful, I imagine, in a lot of ways when you try and make, when you're trying to make sustainability improvements. Technical assistance certainly sounds like it should be much more of a priority.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess all this is just to say, I mean, if farmers are reluctant to try new things in the environment that we have set, you know, available for them right now, who can blame them, right? I mean, there's amazing farmers out there who've been trying new things. I think cover crops is one that, you know, cover crops is pretty straightforward, right? You want to, during the time of the year when you're not planting or having your primary commodity crop or your primary crop out there, plant a cover crop so that it can keep the soil covered, keep live roots in the ground. And if you can make that work, then it's just instead of having a bare field, you have a field with cover crops, right? And there's been a lot of interest in getting cover crops rolled out over more of the country. And so there's been more incentives and there's been more support and there's been more stories. But even that, you know, I think it's, you know, there's just so many barriers that's what I think we can all be working on, is trying to figure out how do we break down some of those barriers, because this can be considered a big ask. You know, there's mm-hmm. a huge opportunity for farmers. I think at least that's what it looks like from the science and from the farmers who have shared their stories. There's just really a lot of things to be excited about, but we have to realize also the barriers that are involved and the challenges, mm-hmm. and that the system that we have today in this country is just not necessarily
helpful
supporting that kind of transition, right?
Yeah.
There's work to do.
What is the role that industry can play in helping to support farmers to make some of these changes?
I mean, industry sources a lot of products from mm-hmm. a lot of farmers and ranchers, and so, you know, they have an opportunity to set some standards and or, you know, provide their own incentives to farmers or technical assistance and support to help the farmers who are farming the products that they buy to make sure that those are produced in a way that, you know, is in line with the vision and the mission and the ideals of that industry. So, and as you've said, I mean, a lot of times farmers have very close connections with industry representatives, and so that's an opportunity too. There's a connection there between farmers and other folks who are able to help communicate, you know, what new practices, new opportunities that can help that farm thrive. So I think that there's a role for industry to play. You know, there is an opportunity for them in this space. Not to mention the fact that the report shows that their businesses are at risk, right?
Right. Well, yeah. No, that's really important point. Okay, we're going to have to take a really quick commercial break, but stay tuned because we'll continue our conversation.
Okay.
This program is brought to you by Joule Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman-Wadler. I'm the executive director of HRN and a real-life Joule user. When you cook with Joule, there's zero guesswork, so steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is intuitive to use and preloaded with all the recipes you'll need, and it has a great visual doneness guide. Joule is awesome for holiday cooking. It's easy to cook for a crowd, and it's perfectly precise, so you can focus on entertaining without worrying about checking food temps, while Joule does all the work. You can try out new cuts fearlessly. One of the best things I ever made sous vide was a juicy, tender heritage goose with juniper berries, and it was life-changing. And pro tip, Joule is small and packs easily, so you can sneak it along on your holiday travels to be this season's food hero everywhere you go. With Joule, you get perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Joule and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/Joule, code HRN. And happy holidays from all of us at Team HRN.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Marcia DeLong about the new, the fourth National Climate Assessment and what it means for food and farms. Okay, so we're talking about kind of what support, where kind of farmers can get the support to make some of these changes. What about the role of government? I mean, we had a former EPA, head of the EPA, I believe, was like not totally sold on the fact that humans are causing global warming. So that's something. So I'm just wondering, like, where kind of what the regulatory landscape looks like right now for championing policies that could affect climate change.
Yeah. I mean, climate change is, and climate change mitigation and adaptation for that matter, are so wrapped up in just finding ways to have a more resilient, sustainable farm and food system, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can look at it through the lens of climate change, but you can also just look at it through the lens of, like, we need to be making progress on building more resilient farms, dealing with these other issues which are all tied in too, which is the, you know, water quality issues and preserving our limited water resources, which we've been tapping out, you know, in recent years. So that, I mean, that's just kind of like an interesting framing for thinking about what can our government be doing about these challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Right now is we're kind of nearing the end, hopefully, of the farm bill, this next farm bill cycle.
Yeah.
But, you know, the farm bill is a big place where, whether we like it or not, there are policies all over the farm bill which are really tightly implicated in climate change and agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
It helps determine what our research budgets are, what our conservation, what kind of conservation programs are available to farmers and ranchers who want to be adopting the kinds of practices that we talked about, for a whole slew of reasons. And again, those safety nets. So, you know, that's just one of the places, but it's a big one where at least kind of the roadmap is set up for how we deal with climate change in food and farming.
Yeah. And right now I believe there are some pretty big cuts proposed to, conservation programs. So
yeah, we've been, carefully watching the Conservation Stewardship Program in particular, which is a holistic stewardship program which really tries to take some of the best stewards of the land and on our farms and ranches and help them, like, even level up and do even better, and, you know, help us set some of those examples for how we get our, you know, the most functional, resilient farms. And unfortunately, that one has been one that's been really, we haven't really known where that's going to go.
Yeah. I should have asked this before, but I'm wondering, like, what kind of crops, if the report talks about what kind of crops we should be growing more of in this country to help us become more resilient. I mean, like, reducing meat consumption seems like probably a pretty obvious one, but like, what, I mean, what about, are there other crops like hemp, for instance, that we should kind of shift our production more towards?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think the report really pointed to specific crops that we should be growing or not growing. It's more about where they're growing and what management we use to grow them. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, something for us to think about is just how do we get diversity back into our farming system? Because it's the diversity that's going to help get us through the challenges that lie ahead. That means diversity at all scales. So should there be a short list of, you know, corn, soy, wheat, rice, sorghum, cotton, oats, silage that are like, okay, these crops are going to suffer, and that means terrible news for the agricultural sector. You know, it would be nice to think about, like, how we can figure out how to get a more diverse suite of crops out there on the landscape. But there's some in particular that are really cool, right? Like, there was a great book by Liz Carlisle called Lentil Underground, and that was all about a story in Montana of lentil farmers who brought lentils into a crop rotation. So here's the crop rotation again. Mm-hmm. And by doing this, they were able to rebuild soil health. Lentils are one of these crops that help get more nitrogen into soils, and they're drought resistant. So they can, you know, create a more resilient, boost soil health, create a more resilient system, and also they're part of this diverse crop rotation. And diversity is great from an economic standpoint. It's great risk reduction, and I think it would just set us up so much better.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, well, I only have time for two more questions, but I want to know, are there what kind of, like, current major initiatives do you have underway at UCS with regard to climate change in our food system, and anything else about your work that you'd want our listeners to know about?
Oh, well, I would direct your listeners to UCSUSA.org and browse our website, because we are doing a lot of different work on food and agriculture. Some of it's on climate change, but we also have an entire climate change and energy program that does a lot of different work on climate change, looking at sea level risk and renewable energy and so on. And so there's so many different pieces of this that we're doing. On our team, for food and environment, you know, we're trying to understand the science of adapting to and mitigating climate change, what having spongier soils can do for farmers and also the environment, and think about what the most innovative and smart policies and opportunities going forward will be.
Excellent. Okay, and last question. We've talked a lot about what farmers can do to mitigate the effects of climate change in our food system, but what are some things that listeners can do right now?
Yes, listeners can support those farmers. Support those farmers, yeah, who are the ones who are working to build resilience in their farming system, working to hopefully help find climate change solutions. You can support companies who are supporting those farmers. You can educate yourself on a climate-friendly diet is. Now, it's complicated, and it's, you know, it's another avenue that we have in which we can help to reduce our own climate footprints. And, you know, there's always the possibility and always really critical to ask our decision makers to take these issues very seriously. Mm-hmm. So we need more people talking about climate change and agriculture and our food system. But I'm just going to bring it back to support those farmers who are the ones who are trying to find solutions for climate change.
And how do we find them?
We have a challenge ahead of ourselves to figure out how we, those of us who are not farming, can reconnect ourselves to farmers. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of farmers out there who are working really hard to try to find solutions, and they're trying to find the eaters, you know.
Yeah.
So you go to your farmer's market, try, you know, or look up, you know, do some research into what are the opportunities for you to be getting food through food hubs or through CSAs, through farmer's markets. But, mm-hmm, you know, also even your local grocery store, right? It doesn't all need to be limited to these other more intimate settings. But But everywhere we go, we're eating. And everywhere we're eating, there's some farmer who's producing something that is doing it in a way that's really trying to be part of a solution for climate change and part of a solution for our food system as a whole, because it's climate change is huge and we need to solve that problem. We need to be supporting the farmers who are working on climate change, water quality, water conservation, and just building resilient communities, really working to improve the strength of the communities, farming communities across the country.
So every time you eat, there's an opportunity to make a change. I love it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. Yeah. It's so great. I'm really excited about that. And it's a message that we continue to kind of try and drive in this show in particular. Like, just voting with your fork is one of the most powerful things you can do.
And you can also still vote.
Yes,
you can also still vote. And so, the opportunities are just endless.
Yeah, just vote. Basically, just vote.
Yeah.
In two different ways. All right, well, this has been really interesting and informative. Marcia, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show and unpack this report for us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. One more thing before we totally wrap up for our New York-based listeners. Heritage's annual Winter in the Garden Gala is happening tomorrow, December 3rd. So if you haven't bought your tickets, there's definitely still time. Use coupon code EATINGMATTERS for 10% off your ticket price. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as our engineer, Jeet Paul. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they're found. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.